From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made over the next 10 years or so, after the pandemic and during a window of time when our society can make a significant shift in its behavior. Writing for NBC News, astrophysicist Adam Frank argues that the coronavirus is a fire drill for climate change. He writes, quote, "We've been living in a dream. We climb into jet planes and fly across continents, never giving the accomplishment a second thought. We drive to grocery stores, assuming the shelves will be stocked with endless boxes of food. And every day we plug our devices into the wall, sure that electricity will flow from the outlets. Other than the occasional hurricane or earthquake, we have lived our whole lives, taking for granted that this thing we call civilization was a machine that could never fail. It's time to wake up. The international COVID-19 pandemic is many things, but its deepest impact may be fostering a recognition that this machine of civilization that we built is a whole lot more fragile than we thought. And that is why, in the long term, the coronavirus will one day be seen as a fire drill for climate change." End quote. Adam Frank has been a leading voice in the public conversation about climate change and our collective future. In this pandemic, he sees evidence that while we are fragile, we are also very much capable of massive and rapid change, faster than we thought. We're learning it every day during this pandemic, and so after the virus stops dominating our daily lives, we will have an opportunity. What excuses will we have not to act on climate now that we cannot deny our ability to adopt serious shifts? But here's the problem. The coronavirus is an emergency and the most urgent timescale. Many people don't view climate quite the same way. Can we change that too? My guest for the hour, Adam Frank, astrophysicist and author of Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds, and the Fate of the Earth. How are you, my friend?
Doing okay, you know, hanging out like everybody else.
Very busy.
Yeah, it's amazing actually how busy I am considering the fact that, you know, I'm home all day. Yeah, I think, this, you know, everybody's dealing with one version of this or the other, you know, and then, of course, a lot of people have to be out there on the front lines, you know, one way or the other, delivering mail or doing healthcare.
Well, and we are so appreciative of that.
Heroes.
We're going to dig into climate and your piece for NBC News coming up in a bit, but there's a few things I want to work through first. And I got to tell you, I remember a conversation I had with you in my first year of hosting this program, and it was in December, and we were doing this program on Rochester's favorite books, and you were talking about your favorite read, some super smart trilogy, and you were talking about how, at least right now at this moment, on this planet, this is the only place that we know of for sure in the universe where you can walk outside under a sky and breathe and feel healthy and confident and safe. I thought that was an extraordinary comment to make. And now, juxtaposed with where you go, depending on how close you are standing to somebody, breathing doesn't even feel safe. Hasn't it like rocked our sense of like invincibility right off of our foundation?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most amazing things about this is that we sort of, you know, as I said in that article, we just sort of had this sense that for those of us who were born sort of, you know, post-war, certainly, other than a natural disaster, this just keeps going. This, you know, the civilization, you know, my food is just going to show up. I think throughout human history, though, it's been very different, right? People were much more aware of their vulnerability. So this has come, I think, as a shock to all of us that how different we've had, you know, a number of generations, 5, 6, 7 generations where things just pretty much rolled along. And there were other than wars. I mean, you know, World War II certainly was a big deal, but that still, you know, was human made. The idea that the natural world was going to impose its changes. That's really a shock to us.
Kind of a reminder, as you've said, of something ancient in us.
Yes. You know, I often think about this whole thing that's happening. And there's a piece I've been meaning to write for a long time about the return of the old gods, you know, that, you know, they're for much, most of the human experience. You know, we recognize the natural world as a force to be reckoned with, a power, an animate power, whether that was, you know, in the form of, you know, of a single god or many gods. And, you know, we sort of forgotten that. That's why you started off that article with the example of the airplane, right? Because even in a storm, right, we'd be sitting on an airplane and, you know, it's raining hard out there. And you're like, don't worry, it'll be
lightning,
fine. It'll
be wind gusts. Yeah.
Right. You're like, So we thought we were invulnerable. We thought this civilization that we built was invulnerable. And it is amazing. But this goes back to something you and I have talked about, you know, many times where, you know, people often think like, with climate change and such, we've got to save the earth. It's like, no, we don't have to save the earth. We have to avoid, you know, really pissing it off, you know, because it is just infinitely more power, literally infinitely, not infinitely, but, you know, it is spectacularly more powerful than we are. And you know, here it's just a virus. It's not, you know, climate change. It's not, you know, it's not sea level rise. It is literally a microbe. And that is able to, you know, to halt, literally halt civilization.
Yeah, when you and I were talking on the phone last week and you said that you were standing in Wegmans and it felt like an actual movie scene that you see in what are usually like the kind of popcorn but ridiculous disaster movies, like where there's nothing on the shelves and people are looking at each other cross and all of this craziness, and that it's actually happening.
Yeah, there was... So my wife and I made either the mistake, I'm not really sure how to look at it, we watched Contagion.
Which is,
I know. We're like, hey, you know, we're not anxious enough. Why don't we watch a movie that really like lays this out? And it's a great movie, though. I would recommend anybody to watch it in a few months.
Yeah.
But it's amazing to, you know, because, right, that movie, one of the things that movie shows is like anybody who says, we didn't expect this. Like, who could have seen this coming? It's like, this movie was made in 2011 and it completely details everything that's happening.
Yep.
You know, except that the virus, you know, the pandemic is much worse in the movie. But there's a scene in the grocery store, which of course is much more dramatic than my experience in Wegmans, thank God. but it was, you know, that experience in Wegmans was, and I'm sure everybody's had this sense of dread. Like, I go to the grocery store all the time, and suddenly, for the first time, like, everybody's looking at each other. It was one of the most uncomfortable experiences in my life, because everybody had this sense, you know, of, like, what's going on? And, you know, you go over to the meat aisle, and there's nothing. You know, it is just empty. And then, you know, the toilet paper is one thing, right? I don't know what it is with people with toilet paper. Having food, having whole bunch, you know, big chunks of the food sections be empty. Now, of course, you know, that's not a real... There wasn't a real shortage there. It was people's behavior. It was that palpable sense of like, I've always thought this was going to be here, and now it's not, or now it's not functioning the way I thought it was. And that was, you know, that was visceral.
Well, and so, you know, if we are truly, from the moment we are born, cast into uncertainty, we have lived, as you've said, for generations, relatively certain that the lights are going to turn on and that the medicine's going to be there and the grocery store is going to be stocked and everyone's going to be fine. Is there, I want to be very careful with this question because I am not at all. You and I are like everybody else. We're worried about our family. We're worried about, you know, this country and this world is going to be facing painful loss, larger than even we feel right now. And a lot of people we know already know people who've been sick, and it's going to get worse. So I don't want to be insensitive to that because I share the same consternation everybody has here. But is there a separate of the loss? Is there value in being moved off of our foundation of certainty back into feeling the uncertainty that has always probably been with us, whether we realized it or not?
Well, I think that's really, it's the second thing. The uncertainty was always there, right? I mean, the thing about the pandemic was that everybody who studies this knew it was coming, right? You know, so there's this great thing by, maybe people have seen it, that was circulating around, and it was Bill Gates. And Bill Gates was talking about, you know, the things he worries about. And this is like from a few years ago, 2015. And he says, you know, the most predictable disaster there is a pandemic. Right. So, you know, there's nothing about what is happening today that was not fully predicted, fully understood what the consequences were going to be, and fully accounted for in terms of people saying this is what you need to do. And we didn't do anything. Right. We simply did not do what we needed to do to prepare for this. So in that sense, like, what is useful, I mean, that's the wrong word, is this, well, it finally happened, right? And it could be a lot worse, right? You know, you watch those movies, you know, and you can see, my God, this could have had a much higher death rate. You know, this was just coming. It was coming sooner or later. That's what you get when you sort of read these, the reports from 2011, 2014, 2015. And so now it's here. And so, you know, if there's anything that can be taken from this, it's one is realizing that there are existential threats or profound threats that we face that we have been lulled into a false sense of security, and that we are going to have to prepare for them. We are going to have to, you know, just get in the habit of having preparedness, having, so, you know, when I talk about this idea of, like, you know, the return of the old gods, right? You can think, what we know about with pandemics is in the future, we're going to have, you know, warehouses full of ventilators, mm-hmm. just waiting. They're not going to get used. They're just going to be waiting. Those are, like, to appease the gods of the virus, right? You know, whereas beforehand, people were like, oh, that's just a waste. We don't need those. Now we see, no, they need to be there. You know, you're going to have empty hospitals sitting around waiting for when there's a pandemic. So, you know, this has shown us how ill-prepared we are for things that, you know, we know have a reasonable probability of happening. And if they happen, the consequences are so dire that not preparing for them is foolish.
Do you have a hope that we are going to shift our view of what the word hero means?
Yeah, that's been something that's been really interesting, right? So for all, you know, we've all watched the movie, like exactly those movies you're talking about, where, like, something is happening, and then you see, you know, there's the people who just, like, yeah, right, are running and hoarding, and they're, you know, they're like stepping over the little kids, you know, to get their share or whatever. And in the movie, those guys are the jerks, right? And they're clearly identified as a jerk. And then there's the heroes, you know, the person who sort of, like, pushes that guy back to be able to shield the little kid who is going to be overrun by the hoarders. You know, and that person's the hero, right? And so, you know, we all have this choice of what kind of person we're going to be. But ironically, what it means to be a hero now is just to keep the machinery running, right? And that means if you're home and you're taking your care of your kids and you're just holding it together in the face of all of that anxiety and taking care of them, you're a hero. If you're delivering mail, making sure the mail's showing up, you're a hero. If you are, you know, if whatever job you're working at, you know, if you're at an auto repair place and it's open and you're doing it, you're keeping the wheels of civilization going, and you're a hero. So really, all of us who are just making it through each day in the face of this uncertainty, that's what heroism means in these kinds of situations. So, you know, we all have a choice. And, you know, most of us, I think, particularly in Rochester, I'm really impressed that people are really stepping up.
My guest is Adam Frank, an astrophysicist and the author of Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth. And his new piece for NBC News is about how he sees the coronavirus pandemic as a fire drill for climate change. And so let's turn our attention there. I already have some emails, and listeners, if you want to call with your thoughts on whether you see these parallels and whether you think this will be useful as we deal with climate change especially for the next decade, but for the foreseeable future of civilization, you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And as always, Adam Frank, the answer should have been found in Ghostbusters. So here's what I can't quite get my head around. See, there's this scene in Ghostbusters where they're trying to convince the mayor of New York City that ghosts are not only real, but Gozer's coming, and Gozer's going to be on top of a building soon, putting fire and brimstone on the population, and you got to let us take a crack at it. And the mayor's going, like, this sounds crazy. What if you're wrong? And Bill Murray says, if I'm wrong, nothing happens. We go to jail peacefully, quietly. We'll enjoy it. But if I'm right, and we can stop this thing, Lenny, you will have saved the lives of millions of registered voters. And the mayor, and the mayor looks at him very much compelled by the argument of saving the voters and being the heroes. And so there's two things that I don't fully get. And the second one is what I'm worried about the most based on your piece for NBC News. And that's this. I could not believe that we literally had Ford producing ventilators starting 2 days ago, not 2 months ago. Yeah. I mean, we've known that we weren't ready for a pandemic. Then the pandemic hits on the other part of the world, and we still wait weeks or months with the federal government going, we got it. We shut it down. It's not a problem. Don't worry. Buy stocks. Massive disaster. You know, when you could have been doing stuff that would look heroic. And now we don't look heroic. We look ridiculous in a lot of levels. And it's not just the White House. It's the mayor of New York City now. It's not Lenny in Ghostbusters. It's Bill de Blasio, right, who wanted one more workout at a gym before he shut the gyms down. That's leadership. But what I want to know is this. There isn't necessarily a virus or gozer on top of the building when it comes to climate. I mean, there is. We're seeing the effects. But the effects are on a timescale that humans have never been good at dealing with. It's a little bit longer than just the virus is going to be going from China to New York City in 2 months. You got 2 months to prepare. We don't necessarily have climate doing it quite that fast. It's happening fast, but it's not virus fast. Right. Will we see the benefits? Will our political leaders see the benefits? And can we learn the lesson now?
Well, that I do not know. And you know, am I hopeful or not? You know, big question mark. But certainly we've been given the opportunity, right? This is what, you know, the opportunity that comes out of this virus is to see what it looks like when you fail. Right. And that is what we didn't have beforehand. When people talked about climate change and the effects of climate change, you know, it sounded like a science fiction movie. It sounded impossible, you know, and in particular, you know, what we focused on usually when you talk to people about climate change, you know, usually the thing we talk about is sea level rise and, you know, stronger, higher, more powerful hurricanes and heat waves. And it's all about the planet. Right. You know, so you have to imagine, you know, waves crashing over the beach, and, you know, plants withering. But really what this has taught us is it's not about the planet. It's about the human systems. It is about the networked, you know, the complex interwoven systems that make up human civilization and how vulnerable those are. And there is, you know, there is a vast literature about, for example, supply chains. How climate change is going to mess with supply chains. And if anything, this has taught us about, right, when you went to Wegmans, it's like, oh, the supply chain is failing. Like, why isn't that product I'm used to here? You know, the question with the ventilators is all about supply chains, because you can't just like snap your fingers and suddenly make a ventilator. That's a bunch of parts that come from other places, and the material that goes into those parts come from other places. And the raw materials that make the materials, you know, you can go down 6, 7, 8, 9 steps in the web, the spider's web of linkages that makes that ventilator. And so, you know, I think that what this really has shown us, what COVID-19 has shown us, is what it looks like for those systems to be disrupted. And, you know, we just, as you said, you know, we've grown up where every, other than a hurricane or, you know, a very small disaster that lasted a week or so, we have grown up our entire lives when there was always food on the shelves, there was always electricity coming from things, and there were always products to buy. You know, there was always something to replace your carburetor. You know, you could find a repair part. And, you know, those are the kind of things that, that climate change will put under, put at risk. And so at least, you know, at least we now know what it really looks like, right?
So the thing that concerns me most, maybe, let me read a line from your piece, because as we look at the pandemic and we link it to climate, and there are so many links from the initial denials to the politicization, to blaming the media, to not trusting the experts, to not trusting the science. I mean, there's so many links here. But there's, yeah, there's a big difference that you highlight in your piece, and let me read from that. You write, quote, what does this have to do with climate change? Like this pandemic, climate change is also going to push on the networks that make up our civilization. Unlike the pandemic, its effects will be long-term, and there won't be a vaccine that can save us, end quote. That's the thing here that concerns me maybe the most. We have timescale issues with dealing with climate that we're not very good at getting our heads around. And if we are not smart enough or aggressive enough, there isn't a scientist in a lab who's got a vaccine 18 months from now or 12 months from now,
right,
that will say, yeah, we took the carbon out of the atmosphere. And
right,
that, for some reason, that line in the piece stood out to me as going, huh, even if we think we got more time, we don't have sort of a hero on riding in on a scientific horse coming in with a vaccine here.
Right, right. No, that's true. And as you say, you know, there's so many different parallels between this. I mean, you know, the denial that was going on beforehand, you know, when the virus was beginning to hit, and, you know, people, you know, you know, there were certainly people in the administration and elsewhere who were saying, this is not a problem. Don't worry about it. It's going to go away. And it wasn't until, and you saw that in England as well, and it wasn't until, you know, the experts, the scientists who study this had, you know, sat them down and said, look, you are looking at potentially millions of deaths if you don't deal with this, that finally, you know, you got some action. You got some response. So yeah, the denial part, and you know, and I've written so much about this. You know, there's this way in which, you know, the media talks about being living in a post-truth world, right? After after the last election, we've talked about, oh, now we're living in a post-truth world. Oh no, we're not. You know, right? This is what you really see, and this is what's so relevant to climate change. You know, you can only live in a post-truth world for a while, and sooner or later, your misconception that facts don't matter, that there's not a reality that can bite back, that's going to get you. And that's exactly what we've seen, you know, with this thing. So what I think is going to happen, when this is all over, because, you know, it's different regions are going to fare. It's going to depend on, you know, what actions they took. And, you know, we're really, for some parts of the country, we're just looking at it. So, you know, Florida, Louisiana, they're just getting started. When this is over, no matter what's happening right now, there will be a reckoning, because, you know, we're going to have to ask, how is it that a country like South Korea, which is a democracy, could do so well? And the United States, which is supposed to be the most technologically advanced country in the world, we still can't get testing. You still, if you are just somebody who's feeling mild symptoms, you can't get tested. We're a month into this. We're 2 months from the time when China was happening, and we still don't have rapid, you know, pervasive testing. Like, this is phenomenal failure of the United States system. We're going to have to.
And let me jump in. So you're comparing, when you compare us to South Korea, when you look at issues like testing, is the parallel you see with climate that there will be countries that are ahead of this curve, that are changing systems, that are ready, and not just changing systems and wrecking their economies, changing systems and preserving and growing their economies, while we, or maybe not us, but while certain places around the world are not as up to speed on dealing with it, yes?
Oh, God, yeah, that's for sure. Because, you know, you can think of this economically, right? I mean, the world is going to be forced and is already forced to move away from a fossil fuel, a carbon-based economy. Now, there are some countries that are already see that and are already doing the research and development to be able to sell the products, you know, for that new world. And we are being held back, right? We are being held back from doing this. There are countries that understand the role of mitigation, of adaption. You're going to have to change, again, supply chains. You know, you're going to have to change where your ports are. You're going to have to reinforce your ports to deal with hot sea level rise. And again, the United States is way behind on this. Now, of course, you know, the thing about climate change, like, you know, the pandemic, is it's everywhere, and there is no vaccine. So still, you know, even if you've prepared better than, you know, one country prepares better, there, everybody's going to feel it. But again, the countries and even the regions, you know, even the local regions that prepare better and see where they have to go with this are going to end up doing better over the long term.
All right, Adam Frank, my guest. Let me get George in Geneseo first on the phone. Go ahead, George.
Good afternoon. Hey, I'm wondering why the subject of zero population growth, which was discussed in 1970 when I was in college, has dropped off the face of the discussion. Thank you.
George, it's a question that comes up with some routine. Adam Frank, what do you make of the question about population growth?
Well, you know, of course it's true that population is at the root of this, but it's not just population. This is something I've learned over time, because I also, when I began looking at this, you know, 10 years ago, I was like, oh, it's all about population. But it's not just population, because different populations use different amounts of energy, right? So, you know, a person in the United States or Canada uses an enormous amount of energy compared to someone living in sub-Saharan Africa. So it's not just population. And also there is the, you know, understanding that in the developed countries, so to speak, you know, population rates are already starting to, the growth rates are falling. So it's a little bit more complex than just saying, you know, drop the population. Clearly, we are going to have to. Clearly, we cannot have everybody in the world living an American life. I mean, that would be, there's just not enough resources on the planet for that. Or we would be pushing the natural system so heavily that you wouldn't be able to last long with that. But it is, you have to sort of fold into not just population, but the sustainability of the life that population is living. And I do think you probably could bring the population to 7 billion or so and have everybody living a pretty reasonable middle-class life if you were doing it in a decarbonized way.
Adam Frank, our guest, the author of Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth, and a new piece for NBC News titled Coronavirus and Climate Change, The Pandemic is a Fire Drill for Our Planet's Future. And listeners, as we continue this conversation, I want to hear from you on whether you think we have learned enough about ourselves in just the last month, really the last 3 weeks. Have we learned enough to say that we know we can make the changes to handle any emergency? After our only break of the hour, we're going to talk to Adam Frank about timescales and how fast we're learning we can make changes when an emergency confronts us, and whether he thinks we'll be able to draw the parallel to climate emergency just as urgently as we've done with this pandemic. Let's get that break, and I'll tell you what's coming up tomorrow on Connections. It's our chance to talk to Congressman Joe Morelli. Congressman Morelli was scheduled to be on the program yesterday. We had to move that conversation because Governor Cuomo's news conferences, we want to bring those daily briefings to you live, and they've been moving around a little bit. And so the congressman doesn't get bumped much, but he did. And he's gracious about it, and we will talk to him tomorrow, get his take on the federal stimulus and more right here on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get to some more of your feedback here. And Andy, boy, we got a lot coming in now, so let me get to Andy here. Andy writes the following, Adam Frank. He says, if COVID-19 has taught us anything, it's that humans have the ability to change. We just need the will. How do we slow climate change? Go vegan, recycle, buy an EV. Mankind can tolerate a lot as long as we have the correct perspective on how it'll benefit us directly. He goes on to say, it's these emergencies that give us that push. Humans, sadly, follow the law of inertia. We want to stay with the status quo until that big shove gets us moving. That's from Andy. So he's talking about the shove that has got us all staying home with physical distancing, even if that means losing our jobs and dealing with the pain that comes from this. It's been an amazing 3-week change in behavior in this society. Does this tell you enough, Adam, that enough to believe that we as a society can change some of the cynicism? You know, the cynicism that says, well, what are we going to do? Just not have gas stations anymore? We're going to power our vehicles differently? What, are we going to snap our fingers and make that happen? The answer is not overnight, but maybe faster than we thought. Are we learning that fast enough this time?
I think absolutely. I mean, that's really one of the most extraordinary things that comes out of this. I mean, you know, we already knew historically that, you know, as I always like to say, in 1890, there were no gas stations. And by 1920, there were gas stations everywhere. So, you know, even without an emergency, you can have emerging technologies just infect, so to speak, no pun intended, infect the civilization quite rapidly. But here, what we've really seen is that if we're pushed, if we have to, if lives are at stake, we can do amazing things, and that people really want to. People want to help when they're under an emergency. You know, those movies always teach us that, like, oh, in an emergency, everybody crawls over, you know, their bodies to get to the toilet paper first. But actually, most evidence shows that during emergencies, people come together. After major, you know, earthquakes, hurricanes, et cetera, people help each other. And I think, if nothing else, when we come out of this in 3 months or whatever, you know, fully, there's going to be a very strong argument against the usual, inertia, against the usual sort of like, we can't do this, it's too much. We will have seen how rapidly and how powerfully a motivated populace can make changes. So if nothing else, you know, I certainly expect that the climate deniers are still going to be out there denying after this. But, you know, there's going to be a lot of the wind that was taken out of their sails from this.
So, but it's the motivation piece there. And that's what Andy is saying. There's obviously a push societally to make a quick change when there's a pandemic, when people are literally dying. But you have made a, kind of a different point about climate. Climate is not only not as fast of an I understand that things are happening now, but it's not the same kind of two-week, two-month emergency like
right.
a virus.
Right.
And climate change is not just one emergency. You've written that it is a string of longer emergencies. And I don't know that there will be a singular event that gives people the same kind of push that you would have in a pandemic. That's what makes me concerned.
Well, I think that's you should be concerned about that. I think that's a reasonable thing to be concerned about, that people will go back to business as usual and will be like, whatever, you know, I don't want to think about that. However, this summer or the fall, I was out in Berkeley and the wind had come up, you know, and they expected high winds for 3 days. And all of the area around Berkeley, not just Berkeley, but, you know, the entire region east, they turned the power off. PS&G turned the power off for like 6 million customers. Now, whereas in the past, people might have heard that news and gone, you know, from if you're living in New York, go, oh, that's crazy. Those Californians, wow, whatever. Now it's going to send a little bit of a shudder down all of our spines,
yeah.
right? When you see, next time when you see Australia burning, right, as we saw, it's, you know, I think there's a possibility people are going to be like, oh, wait a minute. I kind of know what the consequences of that can look like. And of course, you know, as time goes on, next year, year after, 5 years, you know, 8 years, 10 years, this is going to be all the time, right? You know, and it's going to be much closer to home, the number of hearts. So I think there's a way in which now, I'm hoping, now that we've seen what it looks like, these recurring smaller emergencies, which if we don't do something, will grow ever larger and ever more frequent, are going to, you know, raise the hair on our backs now, because now we know what it looks like when those kinds of emergencies bring down the systems we depend on.
Adam Frank's new piece for NBC News is Coronavirus and Climate Change. The pandemic is a fire drill for our planet's future. Let me get Joanne in Brighton next on the phone. Go ahead, Joanne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Adam, I wanted to praise you for your piece. And
thank you.
Clearly with this... Yeah, absolutely. And clearly with this virus crisis that we're in, it's clear that, you know, not all people are made alike in terms of long-term planning. So, you know, Taiwan has done exceptionally well, along with, you know, Singapore and Hong Kong, I guess, with, you know, they actually had a pandemic plan because of SARS.
Right.
And so now, you know, we're seeing the contrast in the U.S. with us not having a plan. So I really hope that, you know, the climate conversation continues after this crisis in terms of long-term planning.
Joanne, thank you. Adam, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because really, like I said, now the argument, no matter what no matter what happens when this is over, the nature of the climate argument is going to change, right? So when people say, oh, it's not going to be that bad, you're just going to have to say, well, what about the pandemic, right? That was bad. And then when people say, like, oh, it's just a hoax, you can say, like, well, isn't that what you said about the pandemic? And worse than that, we're going to be able to, like, call up, you know, the video of them saying, like, oh, the pandemic, this is just a hoax. It's just a... So it's like, it's right there. It's on tape. It, you know, it's clear that science denial, this epidemic of science denial, that the consequences of it were us potentially having the worst response, or one of the worst responses in the world to this pandemic, being you know, more unprepared than almost any other nation that is being affected by it. And so, in many ways, I think that we're just, no matter what, the contours of the discussion about climate change are forever changed. And that may be one piece that we need to leverage the kinds of preparation that you're talking about, the kind of will to get that preparation going.
Yeah, and before I get back to the phones, just on the subject of climate models, Roger emails the program to say, Are climate models as good as pandemic models? And he finds irony of the president now accepting the models of progressions on the virus after dismissing them, but still dismissing the modeling of future climate. So I'll get that in a second here, your thoughts on that, Adam. But I will just say, you know, for those of us in the public who are not experts, who don't study climate or don't study epidemiology,
right,
it has been remarkable to read, especially for the last month, 5-6 weeks, the epidemiologists, the people who've worked on Ebola, SARS, MERS, who have done this work for decades, everything that they have told us is probably going to happen has so far happened. And that's not a doomsday thing. I mean, one of the things that we're learning is if we can make this rapid change, we can at least bend this thing. And we're obviously doing that. But, you know, I remember the night that there was the first confirmed case of coronavirus in Rochester, people had this sort of nervous feeling like, wow, it's here. But the epidemiologists were saying, no, it's been here. We know it's here.
Yeah.
We're not doing much testing, but we know it's here. And it's not just one case. You're going to see that one case is going to become 10, then it'll be 50, and then it'll be 100, and then it'll be 200. Today, we could see it's over 300 this afternoon with the 4 p.m. update. It's exactly what they told us just a few weeks ago is going to happen. And they have been on the money with this, and I am so grateful for that. Now, that doesn't mean that every single epidemiologist has the exact same forecast and that every one of them would be right. I mean, there's a range of these things, just as there is with climate. But there isn't a whole lot of credible, there's not a whole lot of credible voices, or really any, saying the whole climate thing is a hoax, it's not going to happen, it's all overblown, you know, we're not impacting the climate. And do you think that there are enough of a lesson for those who doubted a month ago that we could see a pandemic, that they'll look at climate and go, well, look, I doubted that this thing was a pandemic and then that happened. Maybe I should listen to the experts more instead of just talking about the fact that I read half of an article one time from some fringy website.
Yeah, right. You know, and of course, again, the climate denialists are going to come up with, you know, it's whack-a-mole with them. They're going to come up with something like, well, climate models are really different than virus models. And, you know, that's crap, right? I mean, you know, it's in general, we use the same science, right? The same, you know, how we deploy statistics, Bayesian methods, you know, when we deal with, you know, virology as we do, or epidemiology as we do with the climate systems, right? Now, you know, there, one thing we can always, as scientists, of course, we're going to be like, well, you know, climate, the zeroth order, as we'd say, epidemiological models are, you know, basically about transmission. It's a somewhat simpler system than like the entire Earth's climate. However, when it comes to climate, you know, we know very well that if you double the amount of CO2 that you're going to get, you know, we know what the climate response is going to be in terms of temperature. That's pretty nailed down. So while I certainly expect the deniers to try and play that game, it now just becomes, you know, so much harder because now we've seen the power of sophisticated mathematical modeling, even in social situations. So, you know, the idea that like somehow, oh, climate has this, you know, completely different set, climate science operates under a completely different set of circumstances than, you know, epidemiology and all of the parts around it that feed into social systems. You know, it's going to be much harder for them to make that argument. And hopefully, you know, obviously with climate, there's lots of people who already know what's going on, understand it. And then there's the deniers, you know, the hardcore deniers. But really, if you look at it, that's a really small percentage of there's only like 9% of the people who really think climate change is a hoax. What there is there's a huge number of people who like just kind of, you know, they're kind of listening with half an ear and they've heard that, you know, what, there's problems with climate modeling. It's those people now, I think we have a much better chance of, you know, they've had this visceral reaction that we're all having to that pandemic. And there's a much better chance that they're willing to listen now.
Well, on that note, let me get Andrew's email. It says, Evan, this is going to be one of my stranger emails to you. Your guest, Adam Frank, drives me nuts today and in the past. Today, sometimes he comes up with some good points on subjects that I don't want to deal with. Then he seems to taunt me by laughing at people that don't agree with him 100%. Then he comes up with some more good points on subjects that I don't want to deal with. So, sometimes it's all in the delivery. Regards from Andrew. So you drive Andrew nuts. I got to say, I think your delivery is great. I love being able to talk to a scientist about Ghostbusters every time I have you on. But for Andrew,
well,
you're driving him nuts.
Andrew, I have to apologize. Andrew, I'm from New Jersey, so this is just like kind of the way we do. You know what I'm saying? You know, nothing comes across like, you know, subtlety is not our way. And in fact, you know, the way you can tell if somebody from New Jersey likes you is if they're poking you, you know? It's like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What's that? What's that? So if I'm driving you nuts, it means I like you, you know?
Or you care, at least.
Yes, exactly.
Let me get back to your phone calls and a different Andrew in Rochester. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Hi. You had Andy, you had Andrew, and now you got another Andrew.
I know.
Yeah. Hey, I want to thank Adam Frank for bringing up the fact that this is pandemic is a fire drill for climate change, and because it really is. And if this doesn't get our attention, nothing will. But I want to go a little bit further. I've listened to Adam speak before. He's a scientist, and he's mentioned transportation, energy, which we need, and hopefully in the future we do that in a way better way. But one thing we don't need, and the thing that connects this virus with climate change, is animals. The eating of animals is why this virus came about. COVID, SARS, MERS, Ebola, AIDS, all will come from eating animals. In one factory farm today in North Carolina, Smithfield Farms are going to kill 33,000 four-month-old pigs every 24 hours. And it's a cesspool of filth and virus-laden factory farm. So the two are connected. We need to stop eating animals, folks, and everybody listening can be a hero. Stop eating animals. You would never kill an animal yourself, but we pay people to do unbelievable, unimaginable things to animals. We know now these viruses come from eating animals, wet market in China or Smithfield Farms in North Carolina. I think it's time to bring that part up. And you have a soapbox, Mr. Frank. It's time to add animals because they're related, climate change and these viruses. Thanks for your show.
All right, Andrew. Thank you. Go ahead, Adam Frank.
Yeah, you know, he's right. I'm not a vegetarian, but he's right. I mean, he's right. Certainly, we need to vastly, vastly reduce the amount of meat we eat because, you know, the factory farms are the scale, the industrial scale of meat production in the world is a huge part of climate change. It's a real factor. So, you know, it's true. And that's why, you know, one of the most important things that in the technologies that people are looking at are plant-based meat, so to speak, right? Meat, you know, the Impossible Burger,
yeah.
Which I have to say is delicious. So, you know, I do agree. And, you know, if you don't want to go vegetarian, you can at least reduce your meat consumption a huge amount. I mean, a huge amount, especially given all the, you know, the plant-based alternatives now. But it's really true. And what's really interesting, when I was writing this article, I found an article about how all the new viruses, exactly what he's saying, these new viruses are often coming about because of the interaction, because as we push further into areas that haven't had human colonization, so to speak, and start farming in those places, then the farm animals come in contact with other animals that have never had human contact, like bats. Bats apparently are a real problem for the production of new viruses because they're very messy eaters and they spit all over their food, which then either we eat or we end up eating or the stuff we eat eats it. So, yeah, so then in a bunch of different ways, it's really true that the industrial farming on the planetary scale is really a problem for us.
All right, back to your phone calls. John in Parenton. Go ahead, John.
Well, my question may just show that I'm ignorant about the types of transmission. But I'm wondering, I haven't heard anything or read anything about the when we get into April and May, June, what the effects of mosquito transmission or other types of insect transmission will be, rather than droplets and et cetera being sprayed on us by a nearby person. Is there anything about transmission from the typical insect carrier?
John, thank you. Adam Frank is not an epidemiologist, but I don't know that I've heard anything about bugs spreading this one.
Yeah, this question is way beyond my pay grade.
Can bugs spread coronavirus? I bet you Google can give us a faster answer than anybody else. and John, I'm tempted to tell you I think not. A number of sources already reporting no indication insects can transmit the virus. But again, consult someone smarter than me, I would say.
And me.
and good luck to you there. Let me read the following from Dave, who writes to say, did I miss something here? Shouldn't we also be discussing how the virus is going to make responding to climate change emergencies more difficult, such as National Guard and first responders succumbing to illness while performing disaster relief efforts? Adam.
Well, you know, I mean, hopefully by the time, you know, we're trying to really deal with climate change, we won't be in the midst of a pandemic.
Yeah.
However, you know, one of the things that's predicted with climate change is you expect more disease. You expect more disease as, so here's the thing to understand. This is what I was writing about in the article. Because civilization is a bunch of networks that are laid on top of each other, transportation, energy, healthcare, food distribution. When you punch a hole in one, it like a fragmenting bullet, it rips through the other ones. And so there is expected to be more disease in a climate changed world because there's been more disruption of those systems. And so the healthcare systems begin to, the food distribution systems begin to feel the effects. So that point is well taken in the sense that you are relying on in a disaster, these networks of disaster response systems, including the people who take care of those things, the people who work within those systems, and they may not be available because they themselves are being affected by the disruption of those systems. They may not have gasoline to get to where things are going on because the gasoline distribution network or the fuel distribution network was broken. The medicines that they need may not arrive because the supply chain networks have been disrupted. That is what we're seeing now, and that is what you absolutely can expect as climate change, as the sequence of one emergency after another, you know, just laying on top of each other, fires, floods, food, failures of crops, you can expect as you get deeper and deeper into a climate change world.
A couple more emails. Yvonne says, just for the record, I love Adam Frank too. Everything he says sounds like he has a ginormous smile on his face. So there you go. You got one vote against you and one vote for you. It's a tie, Adam.
Story of my life.
Edward says, a line from that Woody Guthrie song kind of sums this all up. If you ain't got the do-re-mi, then your needs don't count. What is good and necessary for all of society is ignored if it doesn't generate an immediate financial profit. What do you think, Adam Frank?
Well, I think, you know, really also the other thing we're seeing with the epidemic that is also relevant to climate change is the enormous disparity in care, right? I'm still kind of trying to figure out how everybody in the NBA managed to get tested when no one else in the country could. And, you know, who is this falling on hardest? Who is the pandemic falling on hardest? It's the people who have the least safety net. The people whose health are already compromised because of the failures of the healthcare system, people who have very little or are economically challenged. And so and we already see that playing out across the country. And that, again, is going to determine what kind of people are we, how we respond to this. You know, now that we've seen how ruptured these safety nets are and that it can percolate all the way up to people who thought they were very safe. What kind of country are we? What kind of society are we?
So as we get ready to wrap here, I'm thinking about the stacking of networks. And again, listeners, if you just joined us, my guest Adam Frank wrote the piece, Coronavirus and Climate Change, the Pandemic is a Fire Drill for Our Planet's Future. And we've posted that on our various social media platforms, and you ought to check that out. Fascinating stuff. And looks at the networks that we're seeing right now with the virus, all of the networks. And there's so many examples, as Adam mentioned earlier this hour, just creating a ventilator requires network upon network and supply chains and different systems. All you can't just do it in one warehouse in the same way that you respond to a crisis. There's different networks. And we've thought for so long that we're sort of invincible. Last minute, Adam Frank here. What do you want people thinking about as we relate these two things together and think about our future actions?
What I want people to understand and really think about is that it's what matters most about climate change is not the changing planet, but the effect of the changing planet on these systems. People need to recognize that civilization is a super complicated machine, and you right now, if you kick it even mildly, it falls apart, and climate change is going to kick it hard.
I'm only laughing because it hurts to hear that.
Now we know.
We still have time. We still have time. You've said before we're sort of in the infancy. Maybe we're out of the infancy and we're into the sort of the adolescence in dealing with climate change, but there's time. And if anything, this pandemic, this disaster and tragic situation gives us that opportunity to see what we are capable of. Thank you for the piece linking those ideas, and can't wait to talk to you. Can't wait to see you again in person. This is sort of weird.
That's right. Maybe a while. All right. Thank you. It was a pleasure, as always.
As always, Adam Frank, astrophysicist, author of Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds, and the Fate of the Earth. Listeners, you want a great book to pick up that's relatable? You got nothing to do. There you go. Order that book. It's a great one. Our thanks to the whole team today. Emma Ray Stein is the intern. Megan Mack is the producer who does so much more than you could possibly realize for this program. Rob Braden is the engineer who really kind of holds it together when I'm going off the rails. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you're well. Let's talk tomorrow on member-supported public radio.